This is Tuesday, August 3rd, 2004, the second lecture at Freiburg New Church Assembly. My name is Lee Wolfenden, and my topic this morning is Israel, Assyria, and Babylon. In my previous talk given yesterday, I spoke of the Hebrew Table of Nations, and we're going to skip quite a bit of history between what I spoke of yesterday and today. We're actually not going to skip it. I'm going to give a quick rundown of that history in between just to bring the continuity, to give the continuity between the two periods. But in an overall sense, there's two entirely different things happening in yesterday's topic and today's. Yesterday's topic was the beginning of a church era, specifically of what Swedenborg calls the ancient church or the ancient religious era. Today, we'll be speaking about the end of another religious era, and that is the Israelitish. The human race's spiritual history is divided up by Swedenborg into five general periods, starting with the most ancient church or the most ancient religious era. It's not a church in the traditional sense of an institution, but rather of a sort of spiritual era. And the most ancient one is what comes down to us in mythology as the Golden Age. This was a heart-centered era, and it had its downfall. It started in the creation story in the Garden of Eden and deteriorated, as they all do, until we get to the point of the flood. And it was after the flood that we began yesterday with the Hebrew Table of Nations, with the beginning of the ancient church, a more head-centered era. And eventually that had its decline, although not in quite as spectacular a fashion as the previous one. There wasn't a great world engulfing flood, but it sort of gradually ground to a halt and really seems not to have completely come to an end until the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt. It's a little hard to draw the line quite so clearly between the ancient and the Israelitish. But with the exodus from Egypt, we are definitely in a new spiritual era. And rather than being either a heart-centered or a head-centered, this is a hand-centered religion. This is a religion based on obedience and behavior. And we will get today to the end of that religious era just before the fourth one, which is the first Christian church or the first Christian religious era. And of course, we as new church people believe that we are now in the fifth era, which is the second Christian or the new Christian church. And we tend to think this one isn't going to decline. We'll see if that actually happens. Supposedly, this one gets better instead of worse at the end. We'll find out maybe in the afterlife whether that's true. Okay, let's do some background for today's story. We did get ourselves up to the beginning of the ancient church, up to the end of the flood, and the beginning of what happened after that. And what essentially happened after that is first the family developed, and then the nation developed. The family developed in the form of the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Chapter 12 of Genesis, right after what we covered before, after the genealogies, is the call of Abram to leave his home and native land and go to the Holy Land, to Canaan. It's usually considered that that call came to Abram in Ur of the Chaldees, and I think my grandmother in her dull Bible study notes often refers to it that way, but it seems fairly clear from the story that that call actually came from Haran at the top end of the Fertile Crescent. We've got the map here again, and I'll talk to you about that a little more. But rather than being called from here, he'd already traveled from there. He was up in Haran, right up in here, and came down to the Holy Land from there. So that's the beginning of the Israelite family, of the family of Israel. Later it became a nation. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the stories are fairly familiar to those of you who have read the Bible or grown up through Sunday school. And then we move on to Joseph, who was the primary leading figure in the travels, the moving into Egypt from the initial, they didn't really settle the Holy Land, they just kind of camped there, in a sense. They never really settled in and lived there permanently until after Egypt. So they were sojourners in the land at that time. And Joseph led the charge down to Egypt, so to speak, not voluntarily, but it's a good thing he did. And we then have the story first of the brothers coming down and bringing their family, and it was listed as 70 persons who came down at that time. And by the time they came out, not 430 years later or 400 years, as is usually conceived of, it was actually 215 years later that they came out, because the numbering, when you read that 430, it's actually numbered from when Abraham first went down to Egypt, not from the time that Joseph and his family went down from Egypt. So the Egyptian captivity was not as long as is often thought. It was still a couple of centuries, but it was only a few generations by the long generations that they had in those days, according to the biblical story. So the family of Israel went down as 70 people. And Israel, of course, is another name for Jacob. That's where it came from. When we say the children of Israel, it's the same thing as saying the children of Jacob. And so this is the family of Jacob. They went down as a family. They came back from Egypt, according to the story, having 600,000 men, not counting women and children. Well, that was quite a feat to accomplish in just a couple of hundred years, and I suspect there's a little bit of hyperbole going on there, but the spiritual meaning is based on what's actually written in the text, whether or not it's what actually historically happened. There was the 40-year, there was the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai and all the other laws, and this was what really formed them into a nation. And at that point, they should have gone right into the Holy Land, but they weren't ready yet. The people who came out of Egypt were used to being slaves, and they were not going to be conquering heroes at that point. It was their children who were going to be the conquering heroes. And so those who had been slaves in Egypt as adults all had to die in the desert. It was a 40-year period of wandering in the desert, and by the time they went into the land, there were only two who had been adults, which was defined as 20 or over at the time of the Exodus from Egypt, who went into the land. Those two were Joshua, who became the successor to Moses in leading the people, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh. I always like that. Caleb, son of Jephunneh. He was the other, these were the two spies. I'm skipping a lot of stories, but these were the two spies that came back initially from the land and said, yes, let's do it, let's go in and conquer. But the people listened to the other 10 spies and didn't go in. So we had a group of people who had not been adults in Egypt under slavery actually going in. They were people who had been hardened and learned to trust the Lord by going through the period of desert wandering and having to trust in the Lord through that time. The initial conquest takes place under Joshua, and the people settle into the land, and then it becomes apparently fairly divided, and people just settle into their own areas and do their own thing. There are tribal areas that's been allotted to the different tribes, but there's no sense of national unity, and there's the whole period of the judges in which there's just regional leaders. Whenever they have a problem, the Lord raises up a leader like Samson or Gideon or Deborah, one of these who would come up and would defeat the particular enemy that they had. But it wasn't until the time of Samuel that there began to be a national figure who would begin to unify the entire land as a single kingdom. Samuel was not a king. He was a religious figure, not a priest either, but he grew up in the temple, and he began to be recognized and became recognized as a leader of the entire land. And this led the way to the three great kings of Israel, namely Saul, who was big and strong and tall and looked good, but was a little bit headstrong also and didn't always listen to what the Lord said. And therefore, he did not have a dynasty. He was just a singular king, and he was succeeded by David. And David was the king after the Lord's heart. He was the one who expanded the kingdom. He united both sections of the country, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And he extended the borders of Israel to their greatest extent, conquering or putting to tribute all the people within the land of Canaan and some of the surrounding areas. So he had quite an extensive kingdom that he either ruled directly or controlled. and he passed that on to his son, Solomon. Solomon, the name means peace. Solomon did have a peaceful reign. There wasn't peace very long after Solomon, but during his reign, he essentially went on the momentum that David had built up, and he benefited from all the conquering that David did, and he lived in splendor based on his father's work. He also built the temple. That was when the temple was finally built, and they finally moved from worshiping in the tabernacle, the movable temple that they had, into a fixed temple in Jerusalem. So this is where we stand when we get to the peak of the Israelitish era, really the peak of it in terms of the historical looking back at it, was at the height of David's reign. Because when we get to Solomon, we begin to have the downfall of the Israelitish nation and of the Israelitish era. Downfalls don't usually happen all at once. Sometimes they do, but usually it's the end of a long period of disintegration and of falling away. And when you get the spectacular event, that's just when it finally all falls apart. We've seen this in modern days in, for example, the Soviet Union, which was falling apart for many years, but then all of a sudden there was a spectacular event when they simply could not hold it together anymore. And we think we did it, but in fact there was an internal decay going on, and they were about at the end of their rope, no matter what we did, from their own internal corruptions and problems. And this is exactly what happened, in a sense, with the ancient Israelites. The disintegration began with Solomon. And in the biblical story, there is a key issue that every king is judged upon, and that is whether they are faithful to the Lord Jehovah, and only to the Lord Jehovah, or whether they also worship other gods. So this is the key issue, and Solomon violated this in a major fashion, because he, being a wealthy, powerful king, one of the ways that you solidified relationships with other nations and other peoples was you married their women, you married their princesses, and that made a family tie, and it was done largely for political reasons. And Solomon did this par excellence. He had, according to the story, 300 wives and 700 concubines, and that's a lot of women. And these women were mostly not Israelite. And so they came from other nations. They had their own gods and goddesses, and they said, "Hey, Solomon, you know, you've got your temple. Why can't I have mine?" And he listened to them and began to build temples for his other for his wives from these other nations, and so he began to fall away, and he was told, because of this, the kingdom, most of the kingdom will be torn away from your son. And that's exactly what happened. His son, Rehoboam, when Solomon finally died and his son Rehoboam took over in his stead, the people said, "Our taxes are pretty heavy. We need a little bit of tax relief here," to put it in modern terminology. But that's essentially what they said. It's very expensive to run a lavish kingdom, and that money has to come from somewhere, and it comes from the people. And they support it by giving a fairly hefty percentage of their crops to the king, not to mention handing over good-looking sons and daughters who are going to be courtiers and all of that sort of thing. And the people were starting to feel a burden, and they said, "We need relief. We cannot continue like this." Well, Rehoboam, instead of listening to the older advisors who said, "Listen to them, they have a good point," listened to the young fellows who were with him, and they said, "What are you talking about? You know, we're going to live even higher off the hog than your father did." And he said, he used a fairly memorable phrase. He said, "My finger is going to be thicker than my father's waist." In other words, you think you had it bad under my father, just wait till you see the taxes I'm going to put on you. And the whole northern kingdom rebelled. They set up Jeroboam as their king, and they also, they recognized that if all their people were going down to Jerusalem to worship in the temple, this was going to draw them away religiously from following the northern kings, and they were going to be reassimilated into the south and become loyal to the south. So Jeroboam set up a couple of golden calves in the north and south of the northern kingdom, which came to be called Israel. It's a little confusing because before the whole thing was called Israel. Now you have a northern kingdom of Israel and a southern kingdom of Judah. They needed to have their own gods to keep themselves, their people, loyal to them. So they set up a couple of golden calves, and this became the great sin of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he set up, causing the people to sin. And all of his successors did the same thing. They worshipped other gods. And this was the great evil and the great sin that is always mentioned throughout the entire story of the kings, which is told in the books of Kings, the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. So I could go through all of the different kings that did this, but we can summarize generally and say that in the southern kingdom of Judah, there was a continual dynasty that descended from David. Every time a son died, one of his sons would take over, usually the eldest, not always, and it would go right on down the line. So there was a continuous dynasty in the southern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, it never lasted more than a few generations before somebody assassinated the king who was in there and killed all his sons and took over. And then his son may or may not manage to succeed him. But it was a series of either single reigns or short dynasties, and all of them are said to be evil. Even though some of them were fairly good as political kings and leading the country, they were all considered evil in the biblical consideration because they all worshipped idols, they all worshipped other gods. So by the time we get to the focus for today, we have a divided kingdom. We have the southern kingdom still nominally worshiping the Lord, although their kings mostly weren't very good either. There were only a few of them in there that were really good kings that tried to do a purification and return people to the worship of the Lord. But under most of them, they also set up temples to other gods and goddesses and Asherah poles in the high places. There's all sorts of colorful language in there about how they used every opportunity to worship other gods. So both the north and the south were corrupt, but the south hung on longer and at least had a few kings who did the right thing and tried to bring the people back to the worship of the Lord. The result of this was that in the way it's told in the Bible. Now, in the first lecture yesterday, George Dole talked about how the reason politically why there was able to be this nation in the middle of these huge, powerful forces of Egypt to the south and Babylonian Assyria to the north and west, to north and east, is that this was an interim period when both of them were weak. So if you look back at it from a secular point of view, they just got lucky and managed to come there at a time when there wasn't a powerful enough neighbor to conquer them and put them under tribute and rule them. But that's not the way the Bible looks at the situation. The Bible looks at the situation of they were able to be powerful and in control when they obeyed the Lord. And when they disobeyed the Lord, then the Lord sent those empires and nations to overtake them and to punish them for their sins. And so the Bible looks at it from what we would call a spiritual perspective. Your political power and security is based upon your obedience to the Lord. And I'm not going to engage that debate. It's a fascinating one, but I'm simply going to say that's how the Bible looks at it. And so whenever they are attacked or conquered by a foreign power, the reason given is always that they had forsaken the commandments of the Lord. And I'd like to read about that from the book of 2 Kings. This is each one of the captivities. To give the a little bit more background here before I dig into the text, the north was carried captive first. They were carried captive by Assyria, and they were never heard from again. They were resettled elsewhere, and they simply assimilated into the local population. And considering the fact that they had given up their religion already, they already were not worshiping the Lord, their Lord. They were already worshiping the gods of the nations. It's not surprising that they simply became assimilated into the peoples where they went to, because they were perfectly content to be polytheistic and worship the local gods. And so they didn't have any more identity as the Lord's people. They had become like the nations, and they were therefore simply assimilated. it's from the southern kingdom, which held out another 80 or so years, that all of the present-day Jews come, and that the Jews of the Lord's time came. They held out against Assyria, and so they lasted longer, but when Babylonia took over Assyria, then the southern kingdom fell as well and was taken captive. However, there were still a core group of them that remained faithful to the Lord. They kept their identity, which was wrapped up in their monotheism and their worship of Jehovah. And so they kept their identity even in captivity, probably not all of them, but enough of them to continue to be a nation with a sense of distinct national identity. And these were the ones who later returned and were the nation of Israel, never sovereign as they were before, but at least a distinct political unit and a distinct people. So with that as background, I'd like to read from 2 Kings 17, and we'll see how far we get. This will give you the flavor of not only how the captivity happened, but also some of the reasons that are given in the biblical story. Now, each one of the captivities took place in waves. They didn't go captive all at once, and I'm not going to try to read the whole story for either one of them. So just recognize that this is one of the captivities, one of the times when the northern kingdom was taken over, and there were others before they finally were completely taken over by Assyria. So this is 2 Kings 17, starting with verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, this is how they dated things. They would always date things compared to the kings of the other kingdom. If you're talking about Judah, they'd often date it in terms of in the 9th year of a king of Israel, and vice versa. And it gives us a very nice way of being able to track exactly what king was in power in which kingdom all the way through. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria. You recognize that name. Samaria was the capital, the core region of the northern kingdom. And he reigned 9 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, but not like the kings of Israel who preceded him. That's kind of interesting, even though he ends up being the last. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. But the king of Israel discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him and put him in prison. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, and laid siege to it for 3 years. Apparently, Samaria was also a city and not just a region. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Hala, in Gozan, on the Habor River, and in the towns of the Medes. And this is, the Medes are up in this general region. Here's Media here. So they brought them from the northern part of Israel all the way across the northern part of the Fertile Crescent and settled them quite far away. This would have been perhaps months of travel for them in those days. So it wasn't something where, it wasn't a place where they could easily just run on back to the Holy Land. And if you've heard of the lost tribes of Israel, these are the ones that are being talked about, those northern tribes. And then the biblical text goes on to say why this happened. All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. The Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places in all their towns. High places were places to worship in, to worship other gods. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place they burned incense, as the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that provoked the Lord to anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, "You shall not do this." The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, "Turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees, in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your fathers to obey, and that I delivered to you through my servants, the prophets." But they would not listen, and were as stiff-necked as their fathers, who did not trust the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees and the covenant he had made with their fathers and the warnings he had given them. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. So much for self-esteem. They imitated the nations around them, although the Lord had ordered them, "Do not do as they do." And they did the things the Lord their God had forbidden them to do. We could continue on, but it's pretty similar. And I'm looking to see if I can find the place where it says that he took all of the leading people, but he left the poorest of the land. Well, I'm not finding it very quickly here. So that's enough. That gives you the flavor of not only what happened. The whole land was besieged and taken over by Assyria, and all the leading people were deported. The noblemen, the able fighting men, the artisans, the craftsmen, and of course the priestly class. And it's followed by kind of an interesting story about how they resettled people from elsewhere into the Holy Land, and since they didn't worship the Lord, Jehovah, the Lord sent lions among them to eat them, and so they and attack them. So they sent back to the king of Assyria, saying, "You know, the local god is really ravaging these people. You need to send back one of the priests and tell them what they need to do." And this is back in the time when people believed that there were different gods for different lands. And there's a very strong sense that as far as the people around Israel were concerned, this Jehovah guy was simply the local god. They didn't think of him as the God of the whole earth. They thought of him as the God of this land. And here's a place in the Bible where that is reflected in the story. So they sent a priest back. He taught them how to worship Jehovah in the proper way. So they did that, and it sort of implied that the lions stopped coming. But then the whole rest of the story tells about how, but they kept on worshiping their own gods too. They worshiped the Lord and their own gods, and that was no good. And these are the people from whom the Samaritans of the New Testament came, and this is the big complaint that the pure Israelites had against the Samaritans, is they worship, yes, they worshiped Jehovah, but they also worshiped other gods, and that was strictly forbidden. So, interesting little sidelight on that. Now, when we look at this story, what does it mean for us? We'll get to the other captivity in a few minutes, but I don't want to go too far on the literal level before giving some of the spiritual. If we look at the land of Israel as a whole, in comparison with the other nations, that represents our spiritual life. We have all different aspects to our life. We spend a good part of our life simply working and making our living. And it can be a spiritual enterprise, but in itself, it's a worldly thing. We're out there in the working world doing things, and that's a major part of our life. And if you look at the map, the land of Canaan is really rather small, even compared to the ancient world that they knew. There were vast lands outside of Canaan, and it was a rather small territory. And so we have large parts of our life that aren't necessarily particularly religious. They're affected and are supposed to be affected by our religion, but they're essentially secular pursuits. Israel represents our specifically spiritual life, and that's especially our inner life. It can be our life of going to church, but it's especially the life of our thoughts and feelings, and particularly our spiritual thoughts and feelings, and those are the ones related to love of God and love of the neighbor. So Israel as an intact kingdom represents a time when we have built up our religious and spiritual life and we are living a good life, not just based on outward considerations, but from principle and from spiritual motivations. And I believe that this time period is probably somewhere in our early to mid-adulthood, when we've established ourselves and we're attempting to live a basically good life. And yet we are spending most of our time at this point out in the world and not in spiritual contemplation. So we're out there in the world. We have many pressures that are bearing in on us, just as the Israelites continually had enemies that they had to hold at bay at various times. And there's often only a very brief period of our life when things really seem to be working well, when we feel, I'm really living out my principles. I'm living the kind of life that God wants me to live. That tends not to last very long for us, unfortunately. That would be the unified kingdom. But pretty quickly, after only three kings, it was divided into two, the northern and the southern. The northern kingdom of Israel, in general, represents our thinking side, the truth side of our being, whereas the southern kingdom represents our love side, the heart side of our being. And these start to get separated. Our heart may be in the right place. We may still intend to live the kind of life that we believe that we should, and yet we find our mind being drawn farther and farther away into the beliefs and practices and values of this world because we're in contact with it so much. And this is what was happening spiritually as the northern kingdom was falling away. We may say the most important thing to me is that I do God's will and am charitable to the neighbor. But when push comes to shove, what we really make our decisions based on is, if I make this job change, I'm going to get more money from this. And I need that money because I'm supporting the family and it's really tough. So I'm going to make this job change because it pays more. And that's using worldly considerations and worldly thinking to make decisions about our life. And there may be good and sufficient reasons in our mind to do that, but that's just the deceptive nature of it that begins to draw our mind away from doing things primarily for spiritual purposes. We may think, well, yeah, it's a pretty good job, I'll be doing good in it, but it's really going to make money. So what's the most important thing in our mind? Our mind begins to get drawn away toward other rationales and other reasons for doing the things that we do. And once that begins to happen, our whole spiritual nature is becoming weakened. The northern kingdom was really the crossroads. The southern kingdom was a very mountainous region and not easy to traverse, and therefore it was not on the regular travel routes. Any nation, any empire coming through would hit the north first, and they might very well bypass the south altogether because they didn't consider it important. So the north was the first line of defense against any empire that came from the direction of Assyria and Babylon. When it fell, the south became vulnerable. In fact, when they became divided, the south became vulnerable. And this is the way it is for us. When we begin to make our decisions based on what we think of as rational and practical considerations rather than what we know the Lord is telling us from within, if we pay attention, it begins to weaken not only our mind, not only does our thinking get drawn off into human worldly values, but the heart begins to weaken as well. We still intend to do what's right, but our head is not really backing that up. And so the south becomes weakened, and it's only a matter of time before it gets taken over as well. And this is what happens with us as well. And I'll read in a minute a bit of the story of the southern takeover. Essentially what's happening is our mind says, well, you know, I know that I really should make my career choices based on the good that I'm doing to the neighbor and how useful this job is going to be, but I'm not going to make it based on that. I'm going to make it based on the fact that I can make more money and support myself and my family better. Well, this also begins to weaken our heart's dedication toward doing things truly for love of God and love of the neighbor. And the heart is still there. We're in a job. We didn't choose it for quite the right purposes, but we're still doing good in that job. We're still acting in an honorable fashion and acting in a way that we believe is honorable. And so we have not totally surrendered our motives, our will, our intention to do what's right. And yet, when we start making that more money, hey, it's kind of nice to have that more money. And I'm just using this as an example. For some of you, it may be quite a different thing. I never really managed to get into a job that made all that much money, so I haven't particularly had this experience. So other people may be drawn away by different things. This is really just an example. But as our head says, you know, do this for these worldly reasons, our heart begins to enjoy the outward benefits that we get from that. The southern kingdom was not taken captive by Assyria. In fact, the Lord did a great miracle and prevented, because the king at the time, Hezekiah, prayed to the Lord, he did a great miracle and killed over 100,000 of the enemy soldiers that were besieging Jerusalem. And I guess the king of the Assyrians decided that was enough to make him turn back. I think just about any king would decide if you had 120,000 of your soldiers die overnight that that's probably enough to tell you that you shouldn't be doing this. So they were able to hold out longer. The heart doesn't give in as soon as the head does. But sooner or later, we begin enjoying the choices that our head has led us to make, and we begin to get pulled off into not only rationally deciding from a human's perspective this is what I should do, but saying, you know, that was pretty good to do that, and I kind of like this fancy car. I kind of like this bigger house that I've got, and the heart begins to get pulled off by those things as well. So this is the captivity of the southern kingdom, and once again it happens in stages, but I'd like to read to you from 2 Kings chapter 24 some parts of that captivity that took place. This is 2 Kings 24, starting with verse 8. Jehoiachin, king of Judah, was 18 years of old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. That was a pretty short reign. We'd already been told about Jehoiakim before, and the beginning of the captivity took place under him. Jehoiachin's mother's name was Nehushta, daughter of Elnathan. She was from Jerusalem. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father had done. At that time, the officers of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, advanced on Jerusalem and laid siege to it. And Nebuchadnezzar himself came up to the city while his officers were besieging it. Jehoiachin, king of Judah, his mother, his attendants, his nobles, and his officials all surrendered to him. In the 8th year of the reign of the king of Babylon, he took Jehoiachin prisoner. As the Lord had declared, Nebuchadnezzar, and notice that little phrase in there, as the Lord had declared, the Lord had told them this was going to happen. It hadn't come without warning. And he told them what they needed to do not to have it happen, which was to go back to obeying him and worshiping him only, and they hadn't done it. So as the Lord had declared, Nebuchadnezzar removed all the treasures from the temple of the Lord and from the royal palace and took away all the gold articles that Solomon, king of Israel, had made for the temple of the Lord. He carried into exile all Jerusalem, all the officers and fighting men, and all the craftsmen and artisans, a total of 10,000. Only the poorest people of the land were left. That's what I was looking for earlier. Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiachin captive to Babylon. He also took from Jerusalem to Babylon the king's mother, his wives, his officials, and the leading men of the land. The king of Babylon also deported to Babylon the entire force of 7,000 fighting men, strong and fit for war. 1,000 craftsmen and artisans. He made Mattaniah, Jehoiachin's uncle, king in his place and changed his name to Zedekiah. We could continue reading on, and it goes on for another entire chapter before the final destruction of Jerusalem, when the army of the Babylonians literally tore down the walls. They destroyed the walls, they burned the entire city, and they essentially made it uninhabitable by any highly developed nation or civilization. It was indefensible once the walls were down and all the major buildings were gone, and only the poorest people of the land, it says, were left in the land. And I just want to say a little bit about that poorest people of the land. This represents the parts in us that still survive, that don't have that pride and that desire to get our own way and to go our own way and not listen to the Lord. There's always that remnant left over. There's always that little bit of good in us that is left over that the Lord can work with to build up a new self in us. So the poorest people, Jesus said, blessed are the poor. And in another place he said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Those are the ones who recognize their need of the Lord. And there is always that part in us. But our head, the part of us that thinks that we know better than God or that we're pretty smart, and our heart, the part that really wants our own way, that says other people ought to do what I say and say how great I am just because they should, those are the parts that fall. But there are always those poorest in the land, those remnants of our personality that are willing to admit that we need God's help and leadership and guidance. So the southern kingdom gets taken captive by Babylon. The rest of the story is for another time, but as I said earlier, they do retain their identity. There is, even in our heart, in the leading part of ourselves, there is a sense and a knowledge that we have gone wrong and that we need to return to the Lord. And so there is a remnant of the people also preserved in Babylon. And some of the prophets, such as Daniel, their stories take place in Babylon, and it tells the struggles of the remaining faithful to remain faithful to their God and their religion during this period of captivity. And much of what we read in the Bible story is the later looking back and trying to make sense of what happened. And the way they made sense of it is to recognize we did not follow the way of the Lord. We were not right in the eyes of the Lord. We were stiff-necked, our hearts were wrong, we disobeyed, and therefore this is why it happened. And so that gives us the same message for our own life. We may think that the forces of the world are the strongest thing. Looked at from a secular perspective, as I mentioned before, it looks like, well, finally one of these kingdoms just was able to become resurgent and Israel didn't have a chance. The Bible story definitely denies that interpretation, and that story of the 100-some-odd thousand soldiers of Assyria dying in the night is the Bible's way of saying that perspective is simply not true. If we think that the world is so powerful and there's no way we can stand against it, we're already giving in to the world. We're already thinking that material things are more powerful than spiritual things. It's when we recognize that the spirit is more powerful than the world, that the Lord can do tremendous things. He can do miracles in our lives that we never would have thought possible, that we can actually stand up against those forces that are bearing in on us, and we can have miraculous salvation from the forces of this world. I guess I've said enough. I think I need to give you a little bit of time here to perhaps ask questions and make comments. If you so desire. We need to get some talkative people to come to camp. Amy.
Close to your mouth, you don't have to worry about it overloading. It seems to be not as sensitive as some mics are. Hold on a second, please. Okay, go ahead.
I wish Bob were here because he's struggling with a decision about choosing a new career, and he's got a couple of ideas and wants to choose one that's most useful. And he had a conversation with Gardner yesterday, and I kind of was in on it a little bit, but Gardner's advice was that, you know, it's really not so much the job, it's like how you approach it. So sometimes it's not so clear, like it may not be the actual physical duty or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, he's really struggling with it, so I don't know if it's, you know, these choices are real clear.
Mm-hmm.
What might be a better, useful thing to be doing, and then also, you know, if the job or the thing that you're doing really matters that much, if it's maybe how you approach anything you do.
Right.
Whether it's working for a big corporation building missiles or,
mm-hmm.
you know, being a minister. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, is that ridiculous?
Well, there, of course, different people have different skills and abilities, and they need to find a place in the overall economy where their particular skills are going to work. I would say that also we are not held to an absolute standard. We are held to the standard of our own conscience. There could be some people who could work in the company that manufactures the missiles, and they believe that they are doing good. There will be other people who believe that's evil, and if those were to work in the missile manufacturing plant, they would be violating their conscience, so they would be judged by that standard. Whereas those who are working there who believe that they're doing right, they're going to be judged by the standard of their conscience. Now, this is not to say that there's not an overall good and evil. It's a question of what we are judged by. Those missiles may end up being used for evil purposes, and that may be an evil thing, but for the person working there in good conscience, it's not evil. And so for us in our spiritual path, the critical thing is that we act according to our conscience. However, that can also be a slippery thing. And if you read the story of these kings, you find that there were some who tried to reform and tried to do the right thing, but it wasn't enough. And one of the questions that we always have to ask ourselves is, am I being a little bit lazy in the conscience? Am I, you know, saying, well, you know, I can say that this is a good thing, and yet if we were to really look in it to a more deeply, we find that what we're really doing inside of ourselves is saying, you know, this would be a darn good job, it would advance me, let's see if I can come up with a rationale to say that it's good. And that is the beginning of the Northern Kingdom taking over, when we're really being driven by the advantages to ourselves, but we're trying to come up with a rationalization to make it look like it's truly good and truly according to our conscience. So it can be very tricky. And if you look at the history of Israel, it's tremendously complex, and so is our life. So these are not easy decisions, but they are things that we're told we need to keep on thinking about and working on and struggling with. Part of the temptation is in the struggle itself. It's testing our character. What is really going to come out of this? Yes, George.
It's you need more different talkative people, I think.
A whole bunch of things. I'll be going into this north-south thing in more detail on Thursday, I think it is, and coming to some somewhat different view of this whole thing. One observation that it finally struck me that this picture of the north as more corrupt than the south really raises some qualifications about the facile assumption of the truth leading stage.
Mm-hmm.
That we should always, that our will is always corrupt and needs to be guided by our understanding. But there's a picture of this whole period in which our understanding is not in very good shape at all.
That's right.
But we still, somewhere down inside, we really want to be decent people. And this is, I think you have to keep these two views of the regenerated process in tension. But I can't keep quiet about one thing. This whole picture of the fortunes of Israel and Judah resting on their worship practice is blasted by the prophet. The prophet says, the first chapter of Isaiah, God is saying, I am sick of your sacrifices.
Right.
Your burnt offerings stink. And Jeremiah is saying, you go to the temple, it's lying words to say, trust in the temple.
Right.
And the picture of reward and punishment that you get in 2 Kings hardly ever works. It's not just that some very good kings get clobbered, it's that some pretty bad ones are wildly successful.
That's right.
Jeroboam II virtually restores the Davidic Empire. And he's not a very nice man at
right.
all. So the picture of you centralize worship in the temple and God is on your side and you worship and sacrifice even to the one. Jehu wiped out the prophets of Baal and purified the northern kingdom from the worship of other gods and idols. And in his days, God began to cut Israel short.
Yes.
And this speaks to me spiritually, saying the whole picture I had for so long of I've got to be good, and if I'm good, things are going to go right, and if I'm bad, I'm going to get punished, and when something goes wrong in my life, what did I do wrong to deserve this?
Right.
That whole thing doesn't work.
That's right. Yeah, there's not much time. In fact, we're a little bit over time, but I'll just make a general comment that we are at this point in a stage of transition from essentially a behaviorally oriented religion to a more internal religion. It was Christianity that took over from this. And one of the things that was happening here is that the previous dispensation simply was not sufficient anymore. It was not sufficient anymore to properly do the outward observances. And I believe we come to that point in our life as well, where, you know, we think all I have to do is the right thing and everything's going to be fine. That's not true. There's still a whole other conquest in our life, and that is especially of our hearts and also of our minds. We have to change from within. We can't just go through the motions and think we're going to be fine. And the Lord continues to, in a sense, assail us. That's an appearance of truth. Until we begin to go to the next higher level, and that is working on the internal person. And I think this has a lot to do with what George is saying, is that there is also not just a question of we've gone bad, but we have to go to another level in order to continue our spiritual life. And that level is from the behavioral to the inner, changing the inner person. Well, as I say, we are over time. I'd love to do more. It's a lot of fun, but I'm going to have to close now. Thank you.